Prohibition has failed again. We just recently celebrated the 75th anniversary of the end of alcohol prohibition. And that prohibition, about which, you know, there's all the untouchables and Al Capone and all of that, lasted only 14 years. And the current drug prohibition has many more years under its belt, but no more success. Instead of treating the demand for illegal drugs as a market and addicts as patients, policymakers the world over have boosted the profits of drug lords and fostered narco states that would frighten Al Capone. We see what a tragedy that the war on drugs is wreaking on the country of Mexico. Today, there are more drugs on our streets at cheaper prices than ever before. There are more than 1.2 million people behind bars in the U.S. We by far lead the world, a large percentage of them for nonviolent drug usage. Last year, I believe we set the record for nonviolent pot offenders being arrested in this country. Under our failed drug policy, it's easier for young people to obtain illegal drugs than a six-pack of beer. Why? Because the sellers of illegal drugs don't have to ask for IDs. As soon as we outlaw a substance, we abandon our ability to regulate, control, and market that substance. There's a smarter approach. It's usually called harm reduction. Reducing drug use is not nearly as important, is it, as reducing the death, the disease, the crime, the suffering associated with not just drug use, drug misuse, drug abuse, but failed policies of drug prohibition. Ethan Nadelman is the founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, the leading organization in the United States promoting alternatives to the war on drugs, grounded in science, compassion, health, and human rights. Nadelman received his BA, JD, and PhD from Harvard and a master's degree in international relations from the London School of Economics. He authored Cops Across Borders, the first scholarly study of the internationalization of U.S. criminal law enforcement, and co-authored Policing the Globe, Criminalization and Crime Control in International Relations. Welcome, Ethan Nadelman.
Oh, thanks, Terrence. It's good to be on your show.
Okay, and thank you for finding the time in this busy week. Before we get into my three questions of It's Broke, Let's Fix It, I like listeners to get to know a little bit about the people behind the work and the ideas. It sounds like in your early studies and even maybe your first book or two that you weren't focused on drug policy. How did you end up gravitating toward that arena?
I'll tell you, Terrence, it actually was a matter of leading kind of two parallel lives. And even my work on international policing and law enforcement really started off with my basic interest in the whole issue of drugs and how we deal with drugs in our society. I mean, if I'm tracing it back, it goes back to turning 18 years old in the mid-70s and going to college up at McGill in Montreal and starting to smoke marijuana and enjoying it and finding it not being a problem in my life or in most of my friends, and wondering about why it was criminalized. And that issue, I just continued to wonder about that. You know, as I got into my 20s, and then intellectually I became more and more interested in the whole sort of underside of foreign policy and international relations and in the intersection of criminal justice and foreign policy. So I wrote this dissertation and book about the internationalization of crime. I interviewed drug enforcement agents around the world. But I always knew there was something fundamentally wrong about the way we were dealing with drugs in our society. And it seemed like there were elements of hypocrisy and a pervasive societal ignorance and elements of this being a new form of racial injustice and a strange exception to our Bill of Rights, a strange violation of civil liberties that was widely accepted. All of this seemed like simultaneously an intellectual puzzle and also something that could be meaningful to commit one's life to changing.
And that's really what you've done, isn't it?
I'd say so. I mean, I really feel like this in a way has become a calling. I mean, it's something I've been involved with for 20 years now as an advocate, and I expect I'll be involved for another 20. And I very much see myself as in the first or first and a half generation of a new movement for individual freedom and social justice.
And let me ask one question about that, and then let's get to those three big questions that I raised. And that is, when you say mid-20s, you get engaged in this, and you look back and you see that there were movements toward decriminalization and so on in the 60s. I think even Carter was going to decriminalize marijuana at least, and then his presidency turned sour and so on. And so you're right around that period. Did you expect that it would be as slow going as it has?
You know, on some level, I didn't think it would be quite this slow going. I didn't anticipate what would happen in 2001 with, you know, Bush taking the White House and 9/11 and the shift to security and the Republicans taking the Congress. I saw what was happening in the 90s as slowly moving in the right direction away from the hysteria of the late 80s war on drugs. So that pushed it back. On the other hand, I have to say, those people who think that there's a Berlin Wall of drug prohibition about to crumble, I've always felt that, wait a second, guys, we are in a multi-generational campaign. You know, we stand on the shoulders and walk in the footsteps of the movements, for gay rights and civil rights and women's rights and even the abolition of slavery. And all of these were multi-generational movements that took 3, 4, 5 generations, where the first generation set out some core principles that oftentimes seemed politically absurd at the time. I mean, look at the statement for women's rights in the 1840s, or look at the statements around abolishing slavery in the mid-18th century, or look at the things about gay rights that were stated in the 30s or 40s. I mean, and yet eventually things change because of advocacy, because of changes in the culture and the society. So I feel that we started off being that early generation, and I see myself handing off the baton to future generations and, hopefully winning some major victories in my lifetime, but knowing that there'll be a lot more to fight for even after that.
Yeah, one of the things that always strikes me when I'm on college campuses and in that, looking at that age group is why there isn't more of a really concerted movement among young people. One of the saddest things I think about this war on drugs is that it brands millions of young people as criminals and gives them an immediate adversarial relationship or guilty relationship or hypocritical relationship with their government just at a time when they're forming, their models of reality. So, Ethan, let me do what I threatened to do, which is basically we've got about 20 minutes, a little less, three questions. How is U.S. drug policy broken?
Well, so many ways, but just to sum it up very quickly. The first is on the area of incarceration. The United States, we have about 4% of the world's population. We have almost 24% of the world's incarcerated population, about 2.25 million out of 9 million total, right? So we rank first in the world in the per capita incarceration of our fellow citizens.
Well, let me get that one statistic, by the way. It was ours and the world's?
Yeah, that basically, I used to say 5 and 25, now it's more accurate to say 4 and 24, but we're about 4% of the world's population, and we have about 24% of the world's incarcerated population, mm-hmm. right? The number of people locked up on drug charges has gone from 50,000 in 1980 to 500,000 today. We lock up more people on drug charges today in America, tonight, than all of Western Europe locks up for everything, and they got a much bigger population than we do. So we're off the charts on incarceration, that's first. Secondly, in terms of the very criteria of the war on drugs itself, have we actually successfully reduced drug abuse, reduced drug-related fatalities? No. I mean, levels of marijuana use and cocaine use go up and down over time, but basically, if you look at the harms of drugs, we've lost hundreds of thousands of lives to HIV because we failed to implement sensible harm reduction policies. Drug overdose fatalities are probably higher than they ever have been. The price of drugs, the availability of drugs has not shifted in any significant way, except perhaps to become more available and a little cheaper over time. So it's failed in that sense. Then if you look on the international side, I mean, people thought that we're going to create a drug-free society, drug-free world. Look at Afghanistan right now. Look at Mexico. Look at Central America. I mean, you see the disaster. It's like Chicago under Al Capone times 50, times 100, right? And then you look at this sort of pervasive, incredible hypocrisy hypocrisy. I mean, how many members of Congress, Terrence, have probably smoked a joint but are unable or willing to say so? You know, we now have, we just see with Barack Obama, right? He's entering the White House, right? You know, he's back in Hawaii on vacation now, the scene of the crime where he smoked marijuana and did a little blow when he was younger. What's he going to do about the millions of people who do just what he did but maybe aren't so lucky? So, are, you know, there's this hypocrisy piece. And then there's the cost. I mean, the cost of spending $50, $100 billion a year on this drug war. You know, now you look at these major state budget deficits, you look at that, what people are trying to deal with, and you look in California, that used to be the state of higher education, is now the state of higher incarceration. It's spending on state prisons went from $5 billion in the year 2000 to $10 billion this past year. So in all of those respects, it is failing, failing, failing. And more and more people know it's broken. More and more people know it busts. But what's a shame is the number of how few people in positions of power are willing to step out and say so.
Yeah, that's the thing that really strikes me always about it, is the cowardice. Basically, the cowardice that we'll get into that a little more when we're into why, into the whys of why it's broken. But the cowardice of politicians, because they're, I always say, because there's a big constituency who wants to keep the drug war going, and there just isn't as powerful a concerted a constituency with the kinds of money that wants to oppose it. So we have the evidence, and you stated the evidence very clearly in many ways. Then the next question is, how did that happen? And there I ask two questions, really. What's the history, and what are the causes?
Well, it's a great question, Terrence, in part because probably the principal problem with the drug war today is the extent to which those charged with enforcing these laws have entirely lost sight of the original reasons, at least the upstanding original reasons for these laws in the first place. And in that respect, it tells you the extent to which the drug war today is like an ossified religion, right, where one begins to embrace, you know, one carries out the rituals and enforces the prohibitions, having forgotten what the original humanitarian and spiritual impulses were in the first place. So if you look at the origins of the drug war, there's basically two fundamental origins to the drug war. There's a horrible and ugly one, which is racism, right? It's that the first anti-opium laws were directed at Chinese minorities, the first anti-cocaine laws at blacks in the South, the first anti-marijuana laws at Latinos and Mexican migrants in the Southwest. I mean, it's about the drug laws being racist in their origin and about the extent to which what determines which drugs are made illegal is not how dangerous the drugs are, it's who use the drugs.
By the way, tell me if I'm wrong, but I've talked with both you and Mike Gray about this fact before, that there's racism, you scratch beneath the surface and there's of prohibitions and there's racism, but that even the alcohol prohibition was in a way a prohibition against the loutish behavior of certain immigrant classes.
Exactly.
The Irish, the Germans versus the upper class WASPs.
Well, it was more, it was really what I would call the conflict between the white Americans and
yes,
not so white Americans, right? Between the white Americans who came from Northern Europe and Western Europe in the 18th century, early 19th century, and the not so white Americans who came from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe in the late 19th, early 20th century, flooding into American cities by the millions, by the tens of millions, and bringing their wine and their beer and their Schlivowitz and scaring the hell out of
yep,
the older generation of white Americans. So there was that ethnic conflict even there,
yep,
right? And so, you know, that was one major origin of the drug war, and it obviously continues to be perpetuated when you see the crack powder disparities and when you see the percentage of the population that's locked up on drug charges that's black or Latino. But there was another piece of the drug war which was not so negative, and that was about the recognition that these drugs could all be dangerous, they could all be addictive, that we needed better controls over them, right? And that's why some of the origins of the drug laws were woven up with the progressive movement and better protection of food and drugs and the creation of the FDA, and it was also tied up with the suffrage movement, a lot of progressive causes. And that was basically about protecting the public health, about reducing addiction. Now, the tragedy, of course, is that now when you look today, fast forward to the current decade, what you see is that the people involved in the prison industrial complex, the people involved in the drug war, the prosecutors, the cops, even the judges, they've essentially lost sight of the fact that the reason we created these drug laws in the first place was to help people, to protect people, not to punish them. mm-hmm. right? And so, what does it mean that when you're trying to pass, my Drug Policy Alliance, we played a leading role in New York and California and New Jersey in trying to remove the barriers to needle exchange programs and to allowing people to get clean needles in pharmacies, all to reduce the spread of AIDS, all backed by powerful scientific evidence. Now, who's opposed to that? You got the whole health community on your side. You got all the right people on your side. All the expert commissions are there. Who's opposing it? The district attorneys, right? The cops. Now, why? They're saying, why are they opposing it? They've entirely forgotten what these laws are supposed to be about in the first place. And that's how the system has become corrupted and in the ways in which it's become illegitimate. I mean, I'll tell you the same thing right now, and because you're in California, Proposition 5, the ballot initiative that just lost last month in California, it would have been the best and the biggest prison and sentencing reform in the history of the country, right? It would have dealt with California's prison overcrowding crisis. It would have dealt with the budget thing. It would have saved taxpayers money. It would have provided $1 billion a year in treatment and rehabilitation, but saved even more on the prison side. And who was opposed to it? The district attorney, D.A. Cooley in Los Angeles, drug court judge Manley in Los Angeles, D.A. Dumanis in San Diego. I mean, you basically had a law enforcement establishment that when push came to shove, and choice A was to shift resources from law enforcement into treatment and rehabilitation and actually help people, but you would lose a little power on the law enforcement side, right? Or choice B was defeat this thing with no alternative solution to offer so they can maintain their own power. They picked, option B. They raised the money. They got the prison guards union, and they beat this thing.
And let me just talk a little bit more about that one, because most of the proposition battles in the state were fairly close. 8 was close. 4 was close. Some of the environmental ones was close. This one wasn't close.
Oh my God!
It was like 65-35.
It was 59-41. Okay. In the final analysis.
Okay.
And you look what happens. Basically, three things happened.
The one thing I want to remember was that the five previous governors all stood up.
The current governor and his four predecessors, and
like a week before,
Meg Whitman, all stood up to do a press conference to condemn Prop 5 in the week before. Not one of them, I think, had actually read the initiative. Not one of them really knew what was in it. Not one of them had an alternative to propose. Not one of them has a creative solution now that California's prison system may be put under the authorities of the courts. Not one of all they knew was that the prison industrial complex was against it, and therefore they were going to line up and do their bidding. Jerry Brown, who wants to be governor,
right.
The prison guards put $1 million on the airwaves to run these puff piece commercials featuring him in it, right? I mean, absolutely shameful behavior. Another DAs did not even know that there was going to be $1 billion for treatment and rehabilitation. It's as if all the expert evidence went out the window. The prison guards union put in and raised $3.5 million. They got the casinos putting in money. They got the alcohol and beer distributors putting money. They got the Republican Party. They got Meg Whitman. All of the sordid interests got together to bring this thing down.
So that
goes. Of course, this is the only initiative on the ballot that would have saved taxpayers billions.
That's right.
But what does Jerry Brown, the attorney general, do on the ballot language? He puts the direct cost in the first line of the initiative, and he puts the savings in the last line. So the citizens go to the ballot, and they say, oh, my God, Prop 5 is going to cost all this money. Forget it. I'm against it. And they never get to the bottom line and look at the savings. Senator Feinstein is running ads saying that this initiative is going to cost taxpayers billions when exactly the opposite is the case. So what you see is that when the big lie is put out there over and over. And the real wake-up call for me, Terrence, was seeing the power of the prison industrial complex.
Yes.
I don't like using that phrase. I don't like the jargon, but that's what it was. When you can tell politicians what to do, and when they don't even stop to ask why, when they don't bother to get a second opinion, when they don't do anything, all they say is the DA's against it, the drug court judge is against it, therefore we're against it, without looking, that's political power, and that's why the drug war persists the way it does.
You just made the point several times that I think I alluded to early on, which is, as I've watched this battle over my lifetime, it appears that for millions of people, I would think, changing drug policy is probably something they absolutely believe in, and it ranks somewhere probably around 5th, 6th, 7th thing, depending on what's hotter than the economy, stop the war, the environment, gender rights, etc. And on the other side is this prison industrial complex, which it is strictly a bottom line money issue. When I tell people that the corrections unions usually rank somewhere in the top three of political donors in the state of California, where political donations, outpace, I think, every other state. They're shocked. But that really is what it comes down to. When you said it was about the DAs and the drug court judges, it really was about these unions and their political contributions, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, you know, look, on the one hand, it's about jobs and it's about overtime pay. That's what's behind the prison guard stuff. That's what's behind, you know, rural state legislators. We're the only growing business in town is the prisons. I mean, that's true in California, true in New York and other states. So it's about jobs and overtime. But I think, and what really hit me about Prop 5 is it's not just about that. It's also about an attitude and about an arrogance within the law enforcement establishment. I mean, we all need our criminal justice system and our law enforcement establishment to protect us from the bad guys, whether they are the white-collar, you know, scoundrels or whether they are people committing predatory crimes on the streets. But they've become a powerful political force in their own right. When the prison guards union, the people who are paid to guard other citizens, becomes one of the most powerful lobbyists in the state capitol, and when they are lobbying for the incarceration of more of their fellow citizens, there's something sick about that distribution of power in our society. And when district attorneys and prosecutors, we have an adversary system of justice in America. It means, you know, criminal defense side, prosecution side. But when prosecutors see political office as an opportunity to run for higher office, when they see getting on drug war bandwagons and scare tactics and playing to the public that way, if you ask, why does it, look, let me step back and say, we have in the United States a crime rate that is roughly similar, apart from gun crimes, to much of the rest of, say, Europe and other advanced industrialized societies. Our rates of drug use are relatively similar to other societies, but we rely on incarceration at 5 to 10 times the rate of other societies. We lock up people more easily. We lock them up for longer periods of time. When they come out of prison, we're more likely to keep them under the control of a parole and supervision system, and we treat them like second-class citizens oftentimes for the rest of their life. In every respect, America is far more draconian, far more severe, and far more backward, right, and cost ineffective than other societies. Now, why? It's not about drug use rates. It's not about crime rates. It's about an attitude. And underlying that is an arrogance of this prison industrial complex that has become an incredibly powerful force in American society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just Republicans. It's Democrats,
right,
who want to
well,
be
listen,
surrounded by uniforms when they run for office.
That's right. All of this stuff got worse under Clinton rather than better. Let me turn to that third question then, and let me tell you, you got about 4 minutes,
okay.
Ethan. How do we fix it?
You know,
and if you can slip into that, whether we should expect good or ill from an Obama administration?
Well, I think the only way to fix it is obviously to give greater priority to this issue and to develop a growing and more powerful movement. There is a nascent drug policy reform movement in this country. You were talking, Terrence, about the college campuses, and I mean, there's an organization, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, which now has hundreds of chapters around the country, and in many universities is the most dynamic student activism going on today. I'll tell you, there are a range of statewide and national organizations. Drug Policy Alliance is the biggest, but there are a lot of others fighting for this sort of stuff. So the first thing is to become active, engaged, go to our website, drugpolicy.org, you know, get involved. Secondly, these state budget deficits create an enormous opportunity. I think
yes.
That 2009 is going to be the first year in which prison populations actually decline in this country in many decades, and it's going to be primarily because of the state budget deficits. There's big opportunities in California and other states, and we got to push hard so that this is done intelligently and not just in the ways that protect the interests of those already in the system. Thirdly, I think Obama has said the right things and done good things during his campaign. He talked about shifting drug control to a public health paradigm, about stopping the federal raids on medical marijuana in California and other states, about legalizing needle exchange nationally, about treatment instead of incarceration. The Vice President-elect Joe Biden introduced the most far-reaching crack powder sentencing reform bill. These are all good steps. They're not going to make it a priority, but it's our job to make them do what they say they want to do.
And there's also Bill Richardson in Commerce. I don't know where Commerce has any influence on this, but I noted Bill Richardson's courage in that once he had announced for president, he still was an advocate for a medical marijuana policy in New Mexico.
At one point, some poor guy was arrested on a real medical marijuana patient was arrested down in New Mexico, and it was an outrageous case, and Richardson was on the campaign trail, and he said, if those guys want to arrest somebody, let them arrest me instead. So Richardson did not get this issue 3-4 years ago, but he embraced it and owned it and did some very, very important things.
And did it at a time when it didn't look to me it was doing him any good in the conventional wisdom.
Well, you look at the polls and you see 70-75% of Americans say marijuana should be legal for medical purposes, and they don't approve of the federal raids. I actually think that if you're looking hard at the evidence, what you see is supporting drug reform actually is something that the public... Look, the public's not there on legalizing marijuana. The public's not there on the really far-reaching stuff. But they are... 76% of Americans say the drug war has failed and we need an alternative.
Uh-huh.
And they're supporting
76%.
Most of the moderate reforms.
Okay, and finally, that's talking about how to change policy. And this thing that I referred to at the top, which is an approach, which is a harm reduction approach rather than an enforcement and punishment approach, just very briefly... explain to someone who's new to this what that means.
It's basically seatbelts and motorcycle helmets and rubber sidewalks under the playground. It's accepting the reality that people are always going to engage in risky and dangerous behavior, whether it's riding bicycles, playing football, using drugs, what have you, driving too fast, and that rather than try to make believe we're going to create a drug-free world, let's try to reduce the harms and the risk for those people who continue to use drugs, who continue to engage in risky behavior. And that means needle exchange programs, it means designated driving, and it also means things like trying to reduce the harms of the drug war globally. It means thinking creatively and strategically, how do we reduce the power of criminal gangs, how do we reduce the crime, the violence, and corruption, how do we create a new paradigm for accepting the reality that drugs are here to stay, for learning how to live with the reality of drugs so that they cause the least possible harm and the greatest possible good.
Thank you so much. That was the voice of Ethan Nadelman. He is the founder and director of Drug Policy Alliance. The website is drugpolicy.org. And for so many reasons, now adding the budgetary one to the fairness one, to the race, to the racism one, to the health one, to the compassion one, there are so many reasons that this is something that people ought to, rather than just accept the law as it is and maybe do what you did in a covert way, actually become politically active and change this set of rules. Thank you. And again, I always want to thank you, Ethan. You combine the intellectual rigor with the passion in a way that I really appreciate.
Well,
thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Terrence. I'm happy to do your show anytime. Thank
Great.
You so much.